Welcome to today's reading of the Midland Reporter-Telegram and the Odessa American, read by volunteers and staff. You can hear this program on Recording Library of West Texas Radio and on demand at recordinglibrary.org.
This is Dave, and I'm reading from the Midland Reporter-Telegram, Wednesday, April 29th, 2020. This is Section A, the front page. Headline reads, Domestic Violence Rises Amid Shutdowns, by Caitlin Randall. The number of Midlanders charged with family violence in the last month has increased by 33% compared to the previous year, according to data provided by the Midland County Sheriff's Office. Arrest reports show 17 individuals were charged with either family violence or aggravated assault against a family member in the past week. 9 individuals were charged with these crimes last weekend alone. The rise in domestic violence cases is not surprising to Leanna Good, Director of Development for Safe Place of the Permian Basin. She suspects the numbers are actually higher because most incidents of domestic violence go unreported. Statewide, there's been a 40 to 70% uptick in reports of domestic violence, depending on the region and the day, Good said. Law enforcement officials in San Antonio and Houston have seen a spike in these crimes, according to news reports. Sheltering at home is not always safe for everybody, Good said. It's really not. She said coronavirus shutdowns and subsequent oil field layoffs have created a perfect storm of stressors in the Permian Basin, leading to a predictable rise in violent offenses. Between the virus, having kids home from school, and the extreme downturn in the oil industry, distress is intense, she said. Calls to Safe Places emergency hotline have increased significantly, as have requests for counseling, according to Good. Safe Place serves 15 counties throughout the Permian Basin, including Midland and Ector counties. Their 66-bedroom victim shelter is near capacity, Good said, though she emphasized they still have space for victims and their children. If there ever is a time that they don't have the room in the shelter, they'll connect victims with other services, she said. Good said staff at Safe Place are taking extra precautions amid coronavirus concerns, including diligently cleaning the shelter and wearing protective equipment. They've also set aside 2 rooms to be used for quarantining if needed, though Good has said no one in the shelter has experienced symptoms of the virus. The nonprofit is planning to transition into a larger shelter with nearly double the capacity. Good said Safe Place has raised about 93% of the capital needed to break ground on the 112-bed facility. When emergencies like this come up, and with uncertainties in the oil industry, we want to make sure we can serve everybody when they need it, she said. Even after the coronavirus pandemic passes and sheltering guidelines are lifted, Good expects domestic abuse incidents will continue rising dramatically as the economic repercussions persist. In the 40 years Safe Place has been in operation, she said they've noticed a pattern of families flocking to the Permian Basin during boom times, only to have a relationship turn abusive during downturns. The families are usually living in small quarters, and one partner, often the abuser, is working in the oil field, Good said. The relationship might be stable while the abuser has a job, but that dynamic can quickly change, and victims who move to the area with their partners and don't have a support system outside of the relationship can end up feeling isolated. When you get in a position where someone has lost a job, suddenly the person in the abusive situation has nowhere to go, Good said. She said they've secured bus tickets and other modes of transportation for victims who want to go back home or stay with family members. Most victims experience domestic violence several times before they're able to leave the relationship, Good said. The truth is that on average, around the country actually, it takes a victim of violence 7 times leaving the abuser until they'll actually stay gone. If in fact they're fortunate enough to live through the situation, she said. It's something that has to take some time. Sometimes, because people have to understand that it's not their fault. Domestic abuse takes on many different forms and can also occur outside of romantic relationships, Good said. She said elderly parents living with a son or daughter may become targets of violence, and the elderly often feel guilty because they believe the abuse stems from being a burden on their children. This article is entitled Businesses Prepare for Next Steps in Reopening by Mella McEwen. Midland businesses are preparing to take their first steps toward reopening as Texas begins the process of restarting its economy. The month-long stay-at-home order imposed by Governor Greg Abbott will expire Thursday evening, which will allow restaurants, retail stores, movie theaters, and malls to start readmitting customers. Midland Park Mall is one of the 49 Simon Group properties set to reopen Friday, according to the CNBC cable network. Repeated messages to mall management were not returned. Downtown, Wall Street Bar and Grill owner Lisa Johnson said she and her staff were busy cleaning the restaurant and getting ready to open Monday. "We're excited to see our customers and to come back to work," she told a reporter Telegram by telephone. She said the restaurant had been completely closed since Abbott's stay-at-home order last month. "When the restaurant reopens, it will offer dine-in and curbside service," she said. "And in keeping with the governor's recommendations, only 35 customers will be allowed in at a time. Initially, hours will be 11 a.m. to 8 p.m. Monday through Friday," she said. "We'll see how that goes," Johnson said. Susan Golson, who owns La Bebe Boutique in Oak Park Square, 2200 West Wadley Avenue, with her daughters, said in a telephone interview that the past few weeks have been a little different in terms of cleanliness of her store, which offers maternity and baby items. "We'll keep the doorknobs clean, counters clean, everything will be taken care of the best way we know how," she said. She said that because so many of the store's customers are pregnant and have babies, cleanliness has always been a focus. "Thursday evening after we close, I will go over everything. I will take my steamer and go over everything, Golson said. "In the past few weeks, the store has offered curbside service and mailed more items than is the norm," she said. She has also worked with those who had created registries for baby showers that had to be canceled. As restrictions are loosened, she said she will limit the number of people inside the store. "The hardest part has been adapting to cleaning everything. Cleaning the credit cards before we hand them back, cleaning car seats. We carry car seats that are used to carry babies home from the hospital, so we're essential in that." She is looking forward to, quote, "seeing the babies again and hearing the sweet stories from women who have just become grandmothers," she said. Agave Garden, which sells vegetable plants, was considered an essential business, according to manager Katie Young. She said business has continued as normal, with hours of operation unchanged, though social distancing was observed. For example, only 6 people at a time were allowed in enclosures such as the greenhouse, Young said. Agave also offered curbside service, which she estimated will continue for another month. "The garden center has been busier than normal," she said, speculating it was because people staying at home were turning to gardening to pass the time. This is Dave, and I'm reading from the Midland Reporter Telegram, Wednesday, April 29th, 2020. This is Section A, the front page. Headline reads, "Domestic Violence Rises Amid Shutdowns," by Caitlin Randall. The number of Midlanders charged with family violence in the last month has increased by 33% compared to the previous year, according to data provided by the Midland County Sheriff's Office. Arrest reports show 17 individuals were charged with either family violence or aggravated assault against a family member in the past week. 9 individuals were charged with these crimes last weekend alone. The rise in domestic violence cases is not surprising to Leanna Good, Director of Development for Safe Place of the Permian Basin. She suspects the numbers are actually higher because most incidents of domestic violence go unreported. Statewide, there's been a 40 to 70% uptick in reports of domestic violence, depending on the region and the day, Good said. Law enforcement officials in San Antonio and Houston have seen a spike in these crimes, according to news reports. Sheltering at home is not always safe for everybody, Good said. It's really not. She said coronavirus shutdowns and subsequent oil field layoffs have created a perfect storm of stressors in the Permian Basin, leading to a predictable rise in violent offenses. Between the virus, having kids home from school, and the extreme downturn in the oil industry, distress is intense, she said. Calls to Safe Places Emergency Hotline have increased significantly, as have requests for counseling, according to Good. Safe Place serves 15 counties throughout the Permian Basin, including Midland and Ector counties. Their 66-bedroom victim shelter is near capacity, Good said, though she emphasized they still have space for victims and their children. If there ever is a time that they don't have the room in the shelter, they'll connect victims with other services, she said. Good said staff at Safe Place are taking extra precautions amid coronavirus concerns, including diligently cleaning the shelter and wearing protective equipment. They've also set aside two rooms to be used for quarantining if needed, though Good has said no one in the shelter has experienced symptoms of the virus. The nonprofit is planning to transition into a larger shelter with nearly double the capacity. Good said Safe Place has raised about 93% of the capital needed to break ground on the 112-bed facility. When emergencies like this come up, and with uncertainties in the oil industry, we want to make sure we can serve everybody when they need it, she said. Even after the coronavirus pandemic passes and sheltering guidelines are lifted, Good expects domestic abuse incidents will continue rising dramatically as the economic repercussions persist. In the 40 years Safe Place has been in operation, she said they've noticed a pattern of families flocking to the Permian Basin during boom times, only to have a relationship turn abusive during downturns. The families are usually living in small quarters, and one partner, often the abuser, is working in the oil field, Good said. The relationship might be stable while the abuser has a job, but that dynamic can quickly change, and victims who move to the area with their partners and don't have a support system outside of the relationship can end up feeling isolated. When you get in a position where someone has lost a job, suddenly the person in the abusive situation has nowhere to go, Good said. She said they've secured bus tickets and other modes of transportation for victims who want to go back home or stay with family members. Most victims experience domestic violence several times before they're able to leave the relationship, Good said. The truth is that on average, around the country actually, it takes a victim of violence 7 times leaving the abuser until they'll actually stay gone. If in fact they're fortunate enough to live through the situation, she said. It's something that has to take some time. Sometimes, because people have to understand that it's not their fault. Domestic abuse takes on many different forms and can also occur outside of romantic relationships, Good said. She said elderly parents living with a son or daughter may become targets of violence, and the elderly often feel guilty because they believe the abuse stems from being a burden on their children. This article is entitled City. State has been on site at Medical Lodge since April 17th by Stuart Doreen. Midland Health Department officials said Tuesday that the Texas Health and Human Services Commission has been on site at Midland Medical Lodge since April 17th. They are working with lodge officials in regards to their current infection control procedures, their policies, and their actions that they take in regards to following or not following, said Whitney Craig, Midland Health Department Health and Senior Services Manager. Midland Health CEO Russell Myers said that the number of confirmed coronavirus cases at Midland Memorial Lodge in North Midland is up to 39, which includes 24 residents. Of the 15 staff members who have tested positive, 9 live in Midland County, he said during a unified command team press conference. The city reported Tuesday that another employee at Midland Medical Lodge tested positive and that that person increased the number of employees that tested positive to 16. Of the 74 confirmed cases in Midland County, that includes 25 who have recovered, 3 who have completed isolation, and 5 who have died. At least 33 are residents or staff members of the lodge, which is located at 3000 Mockingbird Lane. A sixth person, a male lodge resident in his 80s, died subsequent to the press conference. Chat users topped 940 participants. Justin Bunch with the Midland County Emergency Management Office said Tuesday that 944 people have signed up for the county's community health assessment tool. That includes about 240 in the last 2 weeks. County Judge Kerry Johnson reported on April 13th that chat participants reached 700 in less than a week. Bunch reported in a text that on April 10th, 5.9% of those participating in the chat reported symptoms. That number was 2.1% on Monday. There has been an overall decrease in symptoms from the data provided, Bunch wrote. County commissioners voted to spend no more than $15,000 on Johnson's chat initiative, a partnership with former Midland City Councilman John James. To participate, text the word CHAT to the phone number 432-287-7337. Coronavirus Notebook. Midland Memorial Hospital CEO Russell Myers reported Tuesday that the hospital has received, quote, a significant amount, unquote, of in-house tests and should receive more this week. Midland ISD Chief of Staff Katie Atkins said the district is moving ahead with its plans for an alternative graduation celebration, and more information will be coming from Midland ISD's campuses very, very soon. But in addition to that, we are looking for other opportunities to honor our seniors, Atkins said. We realize this has been a very unusual situation for them. She again stated that anyone with ideas about honoring seniors can do so at Midland ISD's website. Atkins also said all new and returning students must register for the 2020-2021 school year. Parents can register their children at midlandisd.net. This article is entitled City. Medical Lodge resident is county's sixth coronavirus-related death. Health Department confirms 75th case from staff reports. The City of Midland, Midland County, and Midland Memorial Hospital confirmed Midland County's sixth coronavirus-related death on Tuesday. The patient, a male in his 80s, was a resident at Midland Medical Lodge. He was being treated at Midland Memorial Hospital. No other details will be released at the request of the patient's family, according to a press release from the city. He is the fifth Medical Lodge resident to die from the virus, according to Reporter Telegram records. Also on Tuesday, the city announced that the Midland Health Department is conducting its investigation on one new confirmed case of COVID-19 in Midland County, bringing the overall case count to 75. The 75th confirmed case is a female in her 20s who was tested by Midland Health. She is an employee at the Medical Lodge, and her last day of work was Saturday. She is self-isolating at home. The source of exposure is contact to a known case. She is the 16th employee of Midland Medical Lodge to be confirmed with the virus. The City of Midland Health Department will continue to monitor the individual in accordance with the CDC. This article is entitled, Ector County Reports Two More COVID-19 Cases, Total Up to 78, by J.C. Lewis. The Ector County Health Department website reported two more confirmed cases on Tuesday, bringing the Ector County total to 78. There are three probable cases at this time. ECHD has contacted 1,006 people in contact tracing. There have been 1,173 tests taken, with 1,044 negative results and 51 pending results. ECHD reported that 36 people have recovered, four more than was reported on Monday. Medical Center Health System President and CEO Russell Tippin said MCH has tested 678 with 51 positive cases. Three positive coronavirus cases are being treated at MCH, two are being treated on the isolation floor, and one in critical care. MCH has received 596 negative tests and has 31 pending tests. Five patients being treated at MCH are under investigation for coronavirus. Three of the patients are on the isolation floor, and two patients are in critical care. Odessa Regional Medical Center President and CEO Stacy Brown said ORMC has tested 271 people with 13 positive results. There are no coronavirus patients being treated at ORMC at this time. ORMC has received 250 negative tests, and 8 tests are pending. Drive-through testing opens today at the Ector County Coliseum to test Ector County residents. The Emergency Operations Center has closed, Odessa Mayor David Turner said.
Hi, this is Michael. I'm going to pick up one local article that was missed during this morning's readings from Wednesday, April 29th. Opening date not set for Midland's Cork and Pig Tavern by Stuart Doreen. It is not known yet when Midland's Cork and Pig Tavern at Alley Village will open. The Midland City Council on Tuesday approved an alcohol permit for the restaurant that will be located in the Alley Village development along North Big Spring Street. The Midland location will be the fifth for the Cork and Pig Tavern. The other locations are in Odessa, San Angelo, Fort Worth, and Las Colinas in Irving. The Midland location was scheduled to open in the spring of this year, according to an October Reporter Telegram article. That date has been impacted by the coronavirus pandemic, which has hampered the restaurant industry. Documents offered to the City of Midland show 4,560 square feet of business indoors and 900 square feet on the patio. The alcoholic serviceable area of the restaurant shall be limited to approximately 3,900 square feet, according to city documents. Proposed hours of operation are expected to be 11 a.m. to 10 p.m. Monday through Thursday, 11 a.m. to 11 p.m. Friday and Saturday, and 11 a.m. to 9 p.m. on Sundays.
This article is entitled Council Approves New Alcohol Permit for Brew Street Bakery by Stuart Doreen. Brew Street Bakery Coffee and Tea is expanding the hours alcohol will be served. The Midland City Council on Tuesday approved an alcohol permit that will allow Brew Street, located at 4610 North Garfield Street in North Midland, to serve alcohol extra hours on Monday through Wednesday and to serve on Sunday. The changes mean alcohol can be served 10 a.m. to 10 p.m. Monday through Wednesday, 10 a.m. to 11 p.m. Thursday through Sunday, Saturday, and 10 a.m. to 10 p.m. on Sunday. On its website, Brew Street states it offers craft beer and wine along with premium coffee, espresso, and tea. The current hours of operation for Brew Street are 6:30 a.m. to 10 p.m. Monday through Wednesday, 6:30 a.m. to 11 p.m. Thursday through Saturday, and 6:30 a.m. to 10 p.m. Sunday. City documents show a maximum floor area of 2,935 square feet. This article is entitled City Council Okays $9 Million in Construction for Fire Stations by Stuart Doreen. The Midland City Council on Tuesday approved the $9.455 million in construction costs for two fire stations. The contracts awarded to MW Builders are for fire stations in Central and Northwest Midland. City documents show that including construction costs and other past and future expenses, a total appropriation of $11.496 million has been set. Of that money, $9 million is coming from certificates of obligation, which is council-approved debt. The fire stations are numbers 5 and 11. Fire Station 5 at 2210 West Golf Course Road will be a two-story structure totaling 11,752 square feet. Fire Station 11 at 6600 Briarwood Avenue is a one-story structure that is 13,208 square feet, according to a previous Reporter Telegram article. Fire Chief Charles Blumenauer said Tuesday both stations provide current and future help in protecting the community and helping to keep the city's safety rating intact. Fire Station 5 is a rebuild of a facility in an older part of Midland. Fire Station 11 will help Midland deal with recent growth into the northwest part of the city. MW Builders on its website shows four regional locations: Austin, Dallas, Kansas City, and Midland. This is the opinion page. This column is entitled Hospitals in Crisis Because of Elective Surgery Ban by Rich Lowry, King Features Syndicate. We had to destroy the hospitals to save them. You could be forgiven for thinking that's the upshot of the coronavirus lockdowns that have suspended elective surgeries and generally discouraged people from going to hospitals. Many hospitals are getting pushed near or over the financial edge. At a time when we feared that hospitals would get overwhelmed by a surge of patients, they have instead been emptied out. At a time when we thought medical personnel would be at a premium, they are instead being idled all over the country. We are experiencing an epidemic that bizarrely, and in part because of the choices of policymakers, has created a surfeit of hospital beds and an excess of doctors and nurses. Not everywhere, of course. Hospitals in New York City and parts of New Jersey have been tested to their limits. But throughout much of the country, hospitals are drastically underutilized, both because states have banned elective procedures and people have been too afraid to show up. One reason that we didn't want hospitals to get overrun by COVID-19 patients is that we'd crowd out everyone else needing care. But we've ended up crowding out many people needing care as a deliberate choice, even where COVID-19 surges haven't happened and probably never will. Drastic measures were called for when the coronavirus hit our shores and began to spread out of control, especially in urban areas particularly susceptible to the pandemic. It is understandable that we wanted hospitals to prepare for the worst and preserve and muster equipment necessary to safely care for infected people. Hospitals themselves can become a vector for spread of COVID-19, so keeping away people who didn't absolutely need to show up was a reasonable impulse. But this is a case where the cure may be really worse than the disease, or at least has created its own crisis. Elective surgeries are a major source of revenue for hospitals, which have taken an enormous hit as they have disappeared, often in response to state orders. West Tennessee Healthcare, based in Jackson, lost $18 million in March, after the state prohibited elective surgeries and furloughed 1,100 out of a 7,000-person staff, according to Becker's Hospital Review. Summit Healthcare in Arizona expects as much as a 50% drop in revenue after the state's ban on elective surgeries. Philadelphia-based Tower Health, also dealing with a 50% drop in revenue, furloughed 1,000 employees out of 14,000. The examples go on and on and on. Even hospitals in New York State, an epicenter for the virus, are feeling the pinch. Catholic Health and Kalita Health in Buffalo are furloughing workers. So is Mohawk Valley Health System in Utica. Cayuga Medical Center in Ithaca and Columbia Memorial Hospital in Houston. Elective surgeries aren't necessarily what you think. As a piece in The Atlantic pointed out, they aren't just knee replacements. These include procedures for serious illnesses like cancer. A recent New York Times story was headlined, "The Pandemic's Hidden Victims, Sick or Dying, but Not from the Virus." It led with the story of a Rutgers University professor who couldn't get treatment for the recurrence of his blood cancer. As with the lockdowns in general, it's not clear how much of the reduced traffic at the hospitals has been the result of people changing their behavior on their own based on fear of the virus, and how much has been the result of state edicts. But it's certainly true that the prohibitions on elective surgeries, more than 30 governors had issued some version of them as of late April, were too clumsy and sweeping, and not geographically selective enough. Governors in some states are now loosening them up, and it's time for other governors around the country to follow suit, except in true hot spots. In retrospect, the bans failed the cardinal rule of health care. First, do no harm. This column is called Guest View. Pandemic makes local news indispensable, from the Washington Post. We could see it happening, but the speed has been stunning. One day you're a profitable newspaper, doing better every year. The next, almost all of our ad revenue is wiped out with no clear sign of when it will return. So wrote the editor-in-chief of the Riverfront Times on March 18th as he announced the layoff of nearly the entire staff of newspaper and suspension of its print edition because of the economic havoc caused by COVID-19. The St. Louis Alternative Weekly is far from alone as local newspapers across the country cut salaries, furlough workers, and suspend or even cease operations. It's true that much of the local news industry had fallen on hard times well before COVID-19, but the pandemic is inflicting new damage, even as it underscores the crucial role of local newspapers. In this public health emergency, people turn to local media for answers to what the Post's Margaret Sullivan called life or death information, such as where to get tested and is it safe to go outside. Local officials depend on local media to help get information out. Many newspapers, recognizing their role in the community, are providing stories about COVID-19 at no charge online. Some efforts to help are underway. Google recently announced it will launch an emergency fund to help local news outlets that are struggling to maintain operations in the face of the pandemic. It didn't provide a specific figure, but said it would offer grants ranging from the low thousands of dollars for the smallest operations to low tens of thousands for larger newsrooms. Facebook last month said it would donate $100 million to support new news organizations globally hurt by the pandemic. Critics of Facebook and Google are quick to note that their dominance of online advertising is one of the factors that have made life harder for local media outlets. But that's not a reason to reject their help. Report for America, a nonprofit that places journalists in local newsrooms by sharing salary costs, last week announced it was responding to the crisis with the largest expansion of its program, placing 225 journalists in 162 newsrooms since its launch in 2018. Good, too, that others in academia, from nonprofits and in Congress, are looking at ways to shore up local news during this unprecedented public health crisis. The CARES Act, passed by Congress, provides benefits to U.S. companies, but only a few news outlets were able to qualify for benefits under the Payroll Protection Plan. That has added to the push by some for targeted assistance to local news outlets. Some interesting ideas that have been proposed, like a tax credit for publishers who hire local news reporters. But there must be careful discussion, even wariness, about government relief. The independence that has made the American press so valuable should not be compromised for the sake of a government handout. This column is entitled, "Not Everyone is So Lucky," by Megan McArdle, Washington Post Writers Group. At times like these, we have to cling to the simple pleasures, like a nice slice of toast slathered with butter. In the weeks since my father was diagnosed with coronavirus, I have tended to focus a great deal on such things. On Sunday morning, my mouth actually began to water as I watched the pat of Kerrygold unsalted melt into the hot bread. Then I had to remind myself to swallow, because excess moisture makes masks work less well. My father came home Thursday from the rehab facility where he caught and survived COVID-19. We have been incredibly fortunate. His case was never more than mild and currently includes only a minor cough that may be triggered by allergies. The facility said that it couldn't retest him and that anyway retesting wasn't needed. He fit the federal guidelines for release. Thanks to my writing about COVID-19, I knew that the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention guidelines prefer retesting when possible and waiting for two negative results 24 hours apart before considering the patient safe. Just to be on the safe side, we took my father to get tested. I considered this a formality until the results came back positive. The only rooms with doors are upstairs. My father's bedroom and the accessibility adaptations for his bad knees and back are downstairs, where the house is open concept in the extreme and designed to maximize airflow in lieu of air conditioning. So instead of having a sick room, we have a sick house and two well rooms where my sister and I isolate ourselves from him and each other unless we're needed downstairs. My life is now divided into upstairs activities and downstairs activities. Eating toast is an upstairs activity. Making toast, however, a downstairs activity. In between those activities, I have to put on or take off my hastily improvised PPE, a long dress that is worn only outside my room, a bandana over my hair, an exercise mask, and a surgical mask tied over that. When I come upstairs with my breakfast, all of this has to be removed piece by piece in proper order to minimize cross-contamination. After that, my hands, face, and glasses must be scrubbed. About every other trip, I also shower to wash my hair. I leave the toast to my room, which, with all the windows open to the Massachusetts spring, is a balmy 40 degrees. By the time I eat the toast, it is approximately the same temperature. No one prepared us for any of this. The nursing home said my father was ready to come home. No one asked how we were preparing to help him do that, and I doubt it occurred to anyone to wonder. We have 4 surgical masks, which we sterilize in the oven between uses. We were given them only because after the test results came back positive. I called the rehab facility and spoke to them at length about their discharge procedure, at considerably higher volume than normal. No one asked how we would get groceries, now that my sister and I are presumptively exposed and thus required to quarantine. No one tried to find out about the house layout, or whether it was feasible for us to quarantine 500 miles from our homes for 2 weeks after my father's case resolves. Thankfully, it is. But what if he's had kids at home? What if we were an 80-year-old spouse with diabetes instead of 2 daughters in their 40s? No one, including us, remembered the things one might ordinarily do to get ready for such a homecoming, like hiring movers to bring Dad's bed upstairs, are temporarily impossible. Nonetheless, we're extraordinarily fortunate. My dad is not very sick and needs relatively little help. He is home where he belongs and not on a ventilator or locked in a room in a nursing home, as so many other patients are, even if he has to wear a mask whenever we're around. We have money to order what we need, though it may take a week or so to get here. Most importantly, my sister and I know how to research COVID-19, push back against airy assurances, and mobilize resources such as the local elder care office, which has a volunteer grocery delivery system. I mentioned the situation on Twitter and was flooded with offers of help from readers. We have it easy compared with so many people dealing with this disease, but knowing how hard it has been to manage this, even with all my advantages, I keep thinking about the people who are helping sicker relatives with fewer resources. What I keep thinking is we have to do this better. My family may be one of the first to face these issues, but we will not be anything close to the last.
Hello, this is April reading the Midland Reporter Telegram for Wednesday, April 29, 2020. Llamas were brought to a block party Saturday in the 900 block of West Pecan Avenue as part of the Fields Edge Glean Up program, a fundraiser that brings llamas out to the community and funds the pay of homeless individuals to pick up litter around town. For more information on Glean Up, go to thefieldsedge.org/donate. Coronavirus testing set for Greenwood. A coronavirus mobile test collection site will be set up at the Greenwood Volunteer Fire Station, 3103 Farm to Market Road, 1379, 9 a.m. to 5 p.m. Sunday. Tests will be done by appointment only. Appointments may be made by going to txcovidtest.org or by calling 512-883-2400. People will be screened for fever, chills, fatigue, muscle pain and headache, shortness of breath, sore throat, nausea, vomiting, diarrhea, nasal congestion, and loss of taste or smell. WTFB has potential to receive $300,000. The West Texas Food Bank has the potential to receive $300,000 through Giving Tuesday, which is May 5. The nonprofit has received a $100,000 challenge match from the Silva Law Group, PLCC, and the Permian Basin Trial Lawyers Association. The $200,000 raised by the match will be added to the $100,000 that has already donated by Juan A. Silva and the association for a potential total of $300,000. The food bank is able to provide about 4 meals for every dollar donated, so the $300,000 will potentially provide 1.2 million meals, Craig Stoker, WTFB spokesman, said in an email. To make a donation, go to http://weblink.donorperfect.com/WTFB Giving Tuesday now. MCRC receives $10,000 donation. Liberty Mutual has donated $10,000 to Midland Children's Rehabilitation Center as part of an emergency community support group to help independent insurance agents give back to their local community during the coronavirus crisis, according to a press release from the company. The donation will go directly to Midland Children's Rehabilitation Center to provide occupational, physical, and speech therapy, as well as tutoring for children with dyslexia. MCRC was nominated for the donation by Michael McKellar of InSource Insurance Group, which has offices in Midland and Odessa. My team and I have recognized the hard work and dedication performed by Midland Children's Rehabilitation Center during this pandemic, and we are incredibly thankful for Liberty Mutual for providing extra funds to help the community when we need it most, McKellar said in a statement. Grocery store hours during coronavirus. Albertsons Market, 7 a.m. to 9 p.m., 1002 Andrews Highway. For shoppers 60+, 7 to 9 a.m. Monday and Thursday, 3317 North Midland Drive. For shoppers 60+, 7 to 9 a.m. Tuesday and Thursday. HEB, 7 a.m. to 10 p.m., customer 60+, orders can be called in 9 a.m. to 1 p.m. at 833-397-0080. Groceries will be delivered by Favor Delivery. For more information, go to newsroom.heb.com. Market Street, 7 a.m. to 9 p.m. For shoppers 60+, 7 to 9 a.m. Monday and Thursday. Walmart, 7 a.m. to 8:30 p.m., 7 to 8 a.m. curbside delivery pickup for first responders and customers 60+, with disabilities or at risk.
This is the obituary column, Wednesday, April 29th. Cecile D. Brooks. Cecile D. Brooks of Midland, Texas, was called home to her Heavenly Father on April 25th, 2020. A wonderful wife, mother, servant of God, and community leader. She was born September 25, 1935, in Milford, Texas, the daughter of Otis Dude Carter and Minnie Owens Carter. She was preceded in death by her parents, grandparents, brothers Otis, Albert, and Norman Carter, her sister Louise Black, and niece Cheryl Hood. She leaves to cherish her memory and continue her legacy of excellence to her loving and devoted husband of 55 years, Floyd T. Brooks, Jr., her son Kyle, Charlene Brooks of College Station, Texas, her daughter Holly Nicole Brooks Jackson of Little Elm, Texas, grandson Kyle T. Brooks II, and granddaughter Kennedy Madison Jackson, godson Blake J. Black, three sisters Maybeth Tryon, Wanda Jean Carter of Midland, and Ronnie Black Walton of Dallas, 10 nieces and nephews, sister-in-laws Rose, Vera, Peggy, Irish Jean, and Deegi, one brother-in-law, David Brooks, and a host of family and friends, and a special friend in Mrs. Loner Griffin. Due to restrictions pertaining to COVID-19 rules, there will be limited visitation at Llewellyn Garcia Pipkin Funeral Home on Thursday, April 20th, 2020. A private graveside service will be Friday, May 1st at Rest Haven North. Graveside service is under the direction of Llewellyn Garcia Pipkin Funeral Home and Chapel. Family messages and condolences may be emailed to pipkin@nts-online.net, or you can visit our website at www.llewellyngarciapipkinfh.com. Jesse Guevara Villa. Jesse G. Villa, 71, of Midland, Texas, unexpectedly passed away April 25, 2020. He was born on June 7, 1948 in San Carlos, Chihuahua, Mexico. He was raised in Midland, Texas. He then, at the age of 17, met the love of his life, Yolanda Villa. He was survived by his wife of 53 years, Yolanda Villa, son Jesse Villa Jr. and wife Connie, daughters Carol Vasquez and husband Martin, Mari Gonzalez and husband Guadalupe, Roxanne Arredondo, brothers Constancio, Tancho Villa, Francisco Villa, Hector Villa, Joe Villa, sisters Lucy Reyes, Rosa Chavez, Jackie Galindo, and Lisa Gonzalez. He also had 17 grandchildren and 20 great-grandchildren. He is preceded in death by Father Manuel Villa, Mother Victoria Guevara Villa, Brother Trinidad Villa, son Juan Johnny Villa, daughter-in-law Zilpa Villa, and grandson Patrick Villa. Evening prayer was held in a small gathering Monday night due to unforeseen circumstances of COVID-19. Private memorial services will be Wednesday, April 29th, 10 a.m. at Llewellyn Garcia Pipkin. Burial will follow soon at Serenity Memorial Cemetery. Arrangements were made with Llewellyn Garcia Pipkin Funeral Home and Chapel. Family messages and condolences may be emailed to Pipkin at nts-online.net, or you can visit our website at www.LlewellynGarciaPipkinFH.com. Karen Gail Hendricks. Karen Gail Hendricks of Midland, Texas, was called home to her Heavenly Father on Friday, April 24, 2020, at the age of 67, after battling a long illness. Karen was born in Abilene, Texas, on August 3, 1952, to J.C. and Maybelle Copeland. She graduated from Midland High School in 1971 and shortly after met the love of her life, Harley D. Hendricks, whom she married on February 12, 1972. They had 39 wonderful years together. She was preceded in death by her husband, Harley D. Hendricks, both of her parents, J.C. and Maybelle Copeland. She is survived by her sister, Linda Owen, Bill of Miller Grove, Texas, her brothers, Jackie Copeland, Pam, of Dallas, Texas, Terry Copeland, Carolyn, Roger Copeland, Shelley, and Coyett Copeland, Julie, all of Midland, Texas, 9 nieces and nephews, as well as many grandnieces and nephews. In lieu of flowers, please send donations to Texas Oncology, Midland Allison Cancer Center, Gifts of Hope, P.O. Box 1323, Midland, Texas, 79702, or West Texas Food Bank, 1601 Westcliff Drive, Midland, Texas, 79703. Due to COVID-19 restrictions, the family will have a celebration of life at a later date. Arrangements are under the direction of Nellie Picklin Welsh Funeral Home and Crematory of Midland. Online condolences may be made at www.npwelsh.com.
Hello, I'm Jesse. I'm reading from the Odessa American for Wednesday, April 29th. Family needs support with new baby boy. The story was written by Tony Venegas. Daniela Aranda Magar holds her baby son Wyatt in the hospital. Wyatt was born 2 months premature and was being treated at the NICU unit of Odessa Regional Medical Center. The last few weeks have been a time of great change for Daniela Aranda Magar and her family. The Gardendale native gave birth to a baby boy, Wyatt, on March 25th, and is thrilled to have the new addition to her family. Baby Wyatt was released on Tuesday afternoon. Wyatt was born 2 months premature and was being treated at the NICU unit of Odessa Regional Medical Center. Aranda Magar says that baby Wyatt is in good health. There are, however, plenty of challenges that the family has to deal with the new arrival coming home soon. As it stands, Daniela, along with husband Curry and 2-year-old daughter Anne Marie, are all sharing the same bedroom due to water damage in the family's kitchen and parents' bedroom. Quote, "We were starting to renovate the inside of the house due to some minor water leaks," Aranda Magar said. "This happened months ago, and we had to tear out the whole kitchen and one of the rooms connected to it. Everything just went downhill from there," end quote. On top of that, her husband was laid off from his job as an inside sales representative for an oil field company due to the COVID-19 pandemic. With that money shut off, that prompted Aranda Magar to start a GoFundMe account to help pay for expenses associated with Wyatt's medical care, as well as finishing his room with furniture and other necessities for when he arrives home from the hospital. As of Tuesday afternoon, the account had raised $665, with an eventual goal of $1,500. Aranda Magar said that she's also been able to get support outside of the fund from friends and family. Quote, "We've had a lot of support from family, friends, and even other people who we haven't talked to in a while," she said. "That blew my mind because I wasn't expecting it to go beyond that," end quote. What's also helped is that the family had a baby shower just 4 days before Wyatt was born and was able to get some of the necessities needed. The shower was limited to Aranda Magar's mother, grandparents, and two friends, due to government orders limiting gatherings of 10 or more people. "The other difficult part during this time," Daniela said, "is that the family has yet to be all together since Wyatt's birth." Quote, "One of the biggest challenges has been my husband not being able to see the baby," she said. "He was able to be there when he was born, and the NICU did allow him to visit that first day, but that's it. It does stink that he and the rest of the family are not able to see him," end quote. This was done to limit the traffic in and out of the hospital. Daniela said she's been able to come up with a few different ways to keep in contact. Quote, "I was explaining to my husband just how much he's changed in the last month," she said. "The staff lets me take pictures, and I try to FaceTime him once a day when the baby's awake so he can get used to the sound of his voice," end quote. Even with the multitude of challenges the family face, Aranda Magar says that the family has been staying positive and that progress is still being made to get everybody back together again. Quote, "We've been staying positive and lucky with the family and friends helping us out," she said. "The biggest thing for us is to just keep moving forward. That's what helped us a bunch. That and keeping our faith in the Lord and let Him guide us on those next steps," end quote. Judge shutters the EOC. The story was written by Michael Merlo. During a virtual hospital briefing Tuesday, Odessa Mayor David Turner said that Ector County Judge Debbie Hayes decided to shut down the Emergency Operations Center as a working group on Monday. Quote, "I think the EOC serves a vital purpose, especially when it comes to first responders, to be able to have them a place to go stay if they're exposed or are a positive," he said. "Whether it's virtual or whether it's all in the same place, I think it's very important," Turner said. Medical Center Hospital President and CEO Russell Tippin said the decision rested with Hayes. Quote, "This is a county-declared disaster, so the county judge is the chief here, and we have to follow her lead, and if she thinks that that was the appropriate thing to do, then that's for her to decide. I know Medical Center and Odessa Regional, we stand ready to do whatever we can do to help the community, but right now that's the way it's structured, and if that's her decision, then that's what we're going to live by," end quote. Turner said that the EOC is shut down, but that the Ector County Health Department will still be conducting contact tracing. County officials no longer attend the daily Zoom news briefings, but Hayes, via phone, said that the health department, quote, is still county employed, whether they're from the library or the senior center, and that contact tracing continues. Hayes said that the EOC has not shut down or disbanded, but has deactivated, and if more of COVID were to apex, the EOC would come back to support the community. She added that nothing will change after the deactivation, and the county will continue to be unified with other entities involved in the EOC, such as the city and the hospitals. Quote, a lot of people don't understand what an EOC is, she said. Hayes defended her decision to deactivate the EOC because the March predictions of higher COVID-19 cases and deaths did not come to fruition. Emergency Management Coordinator Ricky George said that, quote, the Emergency Operations Center has a specific function. The specific function is to support the incident, end quote. He said that in the COVID-19 response, the health department and the hospitals are major players in that response. Quote, once the support and the infrastructure is in place for that incident, he said, the EOC is generally not needed anymore. End quote. Those personnel are precious, so once they're not doing active work and the incident itself has been supported, he said, then the EOC can go back to normal. Hayes also expressed that the job of the EOC was to help prepare entities like the hospitals for COVID-19 if they were to run out of beds. Quote, we knew we had to put procedures in place to be able to do that, she said, and we did that, end quote. The deactivation of the EOC comes after 10 positive cases were reported in Ector County since last weekend. MCH Director of Public Relations Trevor Tankersley reported that Ector County has 78 confirmed cases with 3 probable cases, 1,173 have been tested, 36 people have recovered, and there have been 4 deaths. Tippin reported for MCH and said that out of 678 tests, 51 have been positive. 3 patients are in the hospital, and 1 is in the CCU. Tippin said 596 tests have come back as negative, 31 are pending, and 5 patients are under investigation in the hospital. Odessa Regional Medical Center President Stacy Brown reported that ORMC has tested 271 people, 13 were positive, 250 negative, and 8 are pending. She said that there are no COVID-19 patients in the hospital. Brown said that they will continue to keep visitor restrictions in place to preserve PPE and keep people safe. Quote, we still really don't know where we stand with the peak and if it will happen sometime between May and June, end quote. She said that ORMC will continue to evaluate the decision and will let people know when visiting restrictions are lifted. MCH Chief Nursing Officer Kristen Timmons added that they still need to be mindful of the protection of those sick people in the hospitals. Quote, as I'm sure we will begin to slowly change those visitor policies, just like we slowly got to where we had no visitors, we'll take some time to really evaluate what the community's looking like. End quote. Dr. Timothy Benton said that testing will begin at the Ector County Coliseum drive-thru Wednesday morning, and only the call center has been functional in the last couple of days.
We've been reading from the Midland Reporter-Telegram and the Odessa American. Please stay tuned for the weather, followed by the second hour's reading of the newspapers.